IDF Commander Motegur said, "The Temple Mount is in our hands," 56 years ago. He was announcing Jerusalem's reunification under Israeli sovereignty to the world. On Thursday this week, tens of thousands of marchers marked that announcement with the annual Jerusalem Day flag parade through the Old City. Singing, dancing, and causing a ruckus along the way, parts of the mostly under 30, largely male crowd can act like a tinderbox eager for a spark. But this year, perhaps taking a page out of the judicial overhaul protests, a group of left-wing activists blocked a main artery from the West Bank's block of Gush Etzion to prevent marchers from reaching the capital. This push-pull political situation in Israel is the stuff scholars dream of. And for Dr. Sarah Hirschhorn, an American historian and public intellectual who focuses on the Israeli ultranationalist movement, her research visit to the Holy Land couldn't have been better timed. We sat together this week, and in our wide-ranging conversation, we discussed the increasing extremist symbolism of the Jerusalem Day flag march. We also drilled down on how Israel's far-right parties are now considered mainstream and in the Knesset's coalition. And we discussed how simply envisioning what the world would look like the day after peace breaks out may be just what we need to actually get there. This week, I, Amanda Borchel Dunn, ask Dr. Sarah Hirschhorn, what matters now?
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today in the Nomi Studios, our Israel Story Partner podcast studios.
Thank you for having me.
Such a pleasure to see you in person after so long that you haven't been able to come to Israel. And I'm very, very pleased to have this conversation with you today. We are facing on Thursday one of the more controversial days of the year. And I'm talking about Jerusalem Day's celebrations of the March of the Flags. So I ask you, Sarah, in this week of controversy and conflict, what matters now?
I think what matters now is what's going to happen on Yom Yerushalayim on Thursday, which will affect not only domestic politics and the precarious coalition that Netanyahu has assembled and needs to keep intact in order to pass his budget by the end of the month, but also a very possible escalation that will affect local, regional, and international geopolitics.
As the listeners can hear, we are recording a couple of days ahead of Jerusalem Day. But all signs are go. It's very, very likely that this march will happen and be protected by over 2,000 police and security members. Of course, we need to remind our audience that the national security minister is none other than Itamar Ben-Gvir, who himself has said that he will take part in this controversial day. What, first of all, makes this day so controversial?
Well, I think this day has become more and more controversial over time. Jerusalem Day began in 1968, the first year after the quote-unquote reunification of Jerusalem, and used to be a much more pluralistic and widespread phenomenon amongst Israelis of all stripes and stars, we could say, religious and secular, from Ashkenazi and Mizrahi backgrounds, and many other groups that were, that participated for decades and decades. In recent years, the march, particularly the march through the Muslim quarter of the Old City, has become increasingly fraught and controversial. And the participation of ultranationalist activists, some of which, of course, have now become members of Knesset, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, have made the day much more political than religious and have certainly changed the tenor of the whole celebration. Of course, the participation of Itamar Ben-Gvir in 2021, alongside some of his other activities in East Jerusalem, certainly heightened tensions and led to a significant escalation, one that I fear might re-trigger the end of this ceasefire that just took place only a few days ago.
Right. As you mentioned, the 2021 march led to an 11-day conflict with Hamas. But do you actually really have great concerns that it will re-spark the violence?
I think so, because if I ask an average Israeli what they think of Jerusalem Day, they might, you know, imagine themselves waving flags in Gan Sako, a major park in Jerusalem, and having barbecues and celebrating the spirit of living in Jerusalem. But if I asked anybody on social media what their image of Jerusalem Day is, it's that famous photo from 2021 that looked like a bunch of ultranationalist youth activists dancing in front of the Kotel with the Al-Aqsa Mosque burning behind it. Now, we know, of course, that that was kind of a false flag, that that wasn't the Al-Aqsa Mosque on fire. That was a tree that had caught flame, and it just appeared that way in the photo. But certainly, I think if you ask anybody on social media, you know, what is Jerusalem Day to them? It's that image.
I think it's that image also for people who live here in Jerusalem in many respects. It's no longer, I believe myself, it is no longer this happy day of celebration. It is instead being, I don't know, co-opted by the National Religious Party. So let's talk about this co-option, and when did that actually begin?
Well, I think it began a bit earlier than the appearance of Itamar Ben-Gvir in 2021. It's been going on over the last decade, not only on Jerusalem Day, but on other holy days or other days of national celebration, and just generally the presence of activist youth in the streets of Jerusalem has escalated over the last several years, and sometimes there's been clashes with police or with other peace activists. So this isn't necessarily new, but I think that Jerusalem Day, because of its significance to the religious Zionist community, has become a kind of focus of attention. And the parade of the flags, this march through the Old City, has become kind of a convenient symbol to organize sympathizers to this message.
Let's describe the march a little bit more. There are tens of thousands of mostly youth, mostly national religious. It's somewhat sex segregated, and it's in a way an excuse for youth to behave badly. Explain a little bit more what I mean.
So I'm going to agree with you that I've actually never been myself, at least to the part that marches through the Old City, because I don't necessarily feel that it's a particularly female or gender neutral space. It's very much an activity that not only is very political, but also seems quite macho, and kind of the, you know, toxic masculinity of Jewish power is also an element of this whole flag parade. And as you said, it's also a lot of really young people, which is true of a lot of these ultranationalist groups, people who both live in the settlements, but also within territorial Israel, that are gravitating towards these groups because they have charismatic leaders and because it's a place to hang out, especially if your home life isn't as stable or as, you know, happy as one might hope. And I think that some of the people who participate aren't even necessarily attracted to the march or to these groups because of ideology, but because of social and, you know, demographic reasons.
It's not necessarily a bad thing. I don't want people to get the wrong impression. What we're trying to drill down here is the repercussions of the co-option of it by the National Religious Party, which also is not a bad thing, but the ramifications and the ripples of, let's just say it outright, racism that goes through the march, at least in clips that I've seen and in talking with people who have been to several of these marches.
I think it's very intimidating, particularly to, you know, members of the Jerusalem community that live in the Muslim quarter or other parts of the Old City who are not Jewish and don't, you know, don't necessarily look upon the reunification of Jerusalem or the capture of the city of Jerusalem in the 1967 war in the same way that the Jewish community who lives in the city of Jerusalem may feel. And Also, I think that over the years, it's become less of a pluralistic holiday for many other streams of Judaism who want to participate in this. I've now seen on, you know, just anecdotally on the internet that there's lots of other alternative activities for people who want to celebrate Jerusalem Day and feel, you know, really deep religious and political significance to this moment and want to reclaim it for themselves in a way that seems a little bit more open and diverse. But the march itself, I think, has become much more narrow and even we might say fringe, though, you know, what was used to be fringe is now in the Knesset. So it's hard to, you know, describe it that way. But I don't feel that the march itself has become or is the same kind of activity that once was. On the other hand, we do see some other groups that are really trying to reinforce a different kind of message, particularly Tag Me'il, which is which is a riff on the word Tag Me'il, price tag operation. They are calling it a kind of a brightening or a more inclusive kind of movement, and they often go to the parade. Or alongside the parade and hand out flowers and candy to residents of the old city to try and reinforce the message that this is a city for everyone, even if the political idea of the unification of Jerusalem is very controversial. So I think there is opportunities to try to take back the streets in a way from what the parade has become. But I think it's less and less of what it used to be 50 years ago, which was just a mass celebration of the city of Jerusalem and, you know, access to the old city, which, of course, was at that time new and novel for the Jewish community in Jerusalem.
Let's talk about what you just alluded to, that the fringe politicians have now become major players in the Knesset. And I would argue that this, in a way, started happening quite a while ago, even with former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, perhaps even prior to that. So how did these settler leaders become such major forces in Israeli politics?
Well, it's a long transition. Of course, this starts back in the 1970s when the Mafdal, or the National Religious Party, became part of the governing coalition for the first time, when with the election of Menachem Begin and the rise of the right in Israel, which, you know, basically changed the political map from a very Ashkenazi socialist Zionist focused Zionism of the 1948 to 1977 period. And the Mafdal, which of course at that time was a party of religious Zionists who had, you know, were just beginning to see the impact of the Israeli settler movement in 1977 and began to kind of grow some of their ideas now that they were in power. But I think things changed significantly in the decade of the 1990s with opposition to the Oslo peace process, which, you know, brought some figures to the national stage. We might remember that even Itamar Ben-Gvir himself was a youth activist in those days, who was out in the streets of Jerusalem, crusading against the Oslo Accords and kind of cut his teeth in those years. And we can point to many other figures who have a kind of similar trajectory. And certainly in the last, you know, several years, with the decline of the peace process and the almost exclusive reign of Benjamin Netanyahu, I think that actually, ironically, has given room on the right for other figures to appear to Netanyahu's right to try to steal the thunder a bit from his, you know, presence as the staunch Mr. Security image, because, there really hasn't been any other prime minister than most young people in Israel know. And I think many settler leaders feel it's time for them to have, you know, get their due and also to stand in opposition to some of Netanyahu's politics.
Before we talk about Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, who also must be mentioned, let's talk a little bit more about the image of Naftali Bennett, who was, we should remind people, was the leader of the Yesha, of the settler umbrella organization.
So Naftali Bennett actually has a really interesting biography for someone who became a settler leader, just like we might consider Theodor Herzl as being like an unlikely forerunner of, you know, modern Zionism. I think we can also see Naftali Bennett in the same way as being kind of an unlikely forefather of the Mafdal, or the new reincarnation of the National Religious Party, because, you know, he himself came from a diaspora background. His parents are American Jews who moved to Israel from California. He speaks English fluently. He wasn't necessarily, entirely raised solely in the Israeli tradition. He has other roots in other places. And he is, you know, cred on religious lifestyle issues, I think, at the time and still even today is a little thin. You know, he wears a very small kippah. You know, his strict observance of religious practice, I think, is perhaps in question. And he lives in La'anana. He doesn't live out in the settlements. He comes from a business background. He's a multi-millionaire, maybe possibly a gazillionaire, who really cut his teeth in the high-tech movement and not as a youth activist in Oslo or any of the other places that we might see settler leaders going about. But I think he has, from his professional life, has a great deal of organizational savvy and is a good networker, and has also shown, I think, even in the last government, a great ability to be a leader and to work across the aisle, as we might say in the United States, while still retaining the integrity of his beliefs. Now, we might not agree with his beliefs, but I think that he was able to do both in the last government.
So he's considered a traitor by many of the current settler movement because, of course, he made a coalition with an Islamic party, Ra'am. And not only because of that, I think he also portrays a different persona than the settler movement is currently looking for, which led to the vacuum, which led to the rise of the religious Zionism party and also Otzma Yehudit. Let's talk first about religious Zionism, Bezalel Smotrich, and what does he signify? He was, of course, the founder of Regavim. So talk about Regavim to begin with.
So first, I just want to say that I think Naftali Bennett kind of got a little bit of a bad rap here. I don't think that he necessarily sold out his ideals, but he was perceived as being selling out his ideas by you know, forming this broad-based coalition. So we don't know what he might have done had he stayed in power. But certainly, his actions were seen as a betrayal of the movement's ideals and of greater Israel and ultra-nationalist values. So he wasn't, he of course now is out of politics, and other people like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, who are seen to be more faithful to who are more of the party faithful, are seen to be those who can be relied upon to push forward this agenda. So Bezalel Smotrich is still a relatively young man, so he's done quite a lot in his very short career, but one of the things that he was very actively involved in is an NGO called Regavim, which is straddles kind of the political and legal vanguard of the Israeli settler movement. No longer the kind of old school Yesha council approach of having an umbrella organization of settlements and different regional and municipal councils that will govern these affairs, but a kind of think tank / activist platform that is going to try and shake up the old way of doing things. And they were able, I think, to insert a lot of policy ideas and platforms into the government and into the legal process regarding the settlements, and could kind of be seen alongside the Kohelet Forum as being another real force in Israel, although one that maybe is a little bit more homegrown than Kohelet, which has, you know, roots and donors in the United States. Regavim is much more local and young and is definitely working very hard on the ground to transform the map in the West Bank.
So let's talk about Itamar Ben-Gvir. And to me, he kind of seems like filling the space of the disruptor. You agree with that?
I think he is. I think also his background is very different from Bezalel Smotrich. He comes from a Tunisian immigrant background. He's Mizrahi. He hasn't necessarily had, some of the, privileges of, growing up within the elite that Bezalel Smotrich and some of his colleagues in Regavim have. So he comes sort of as a disruptor or an outsider, or, he maybe a kind of maverick character in Israeli politics. But he also is able to organize a lot of, younger, disaffected, particularly Mizrahi voters, and some now Chadal voters, people who are sort of on the fringe between the Haredi or ultra-Orthodox world and the national religious world, who really haven't had a space for themselves in traditional national religious Zionism, settler politics, which has also been, you know, heavily dominated by an Ashkenazi elite, you know, people who sort of resemble the Bezalel Smotriches of the world. And this is a new opportunity for people who have a different, you know, a different ethnic and social background to be involved in politics. And I think Itamar Ben-Gvir is, you know, really inserted himself very forcefully in that way. Of course, you know, we don't need to talk about his very controversial trajectory to getting to that position. You know, he didn't serve in the IDF. He was convicted on terrorism charges. He obviously was a youth activist and a major, you know, a major figure known as kind of a troublemaker, you know, throughout his youth. But that has certainly appealed to a lot of Israelis who see themselves on the sidelines too and want to, you know, get into Knesset, just like Itamar Ben-Gvir has.
The bad boy image, in a way. Before we move on, do drill down on Ben-Gvir's trajectory. You talked about him as this activist youth, but it's more than that. He was a Kahana follower. Talk to us about this element.
So I think, as I had mentioned, Itamar Ben-Gvir is the son of Tunisian immigrants who grew up on the outskirts of Jerusalem, now in what is, you know, considered very gentrified real estate, but back in the day was a very, you know, I think, kind of rough transition for many Mizrahi immigrants who arrived in Israel in the 60s. And, you know, he grew up and was very much radicalized by movements that he associated himself with. He, you know, he denies it today, but is certain that he was a pretty proud Kahanist, a follower of Rabbi Meir Kahana, the ultra-nationalist, xenophobic rabbi from the United States who immigrated to Israel in the 1970s and, amongst other groups, you know, tried to mobilize young Mizrahi men to join his movement. He was a street protester. He was arrested any number of times on, you know, disturbances of the peace and terrorist charges. And was convicted on, I believe, 11 of these counts, though don't quote me on that. And, you know, he had, and he became a follower of other, you know, violent members in the movement. You know, he famously had a poster of Baruch Goldstein, the perpetrator of the 1994 massacre at the Tomb of the Patriarchs Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron up on his wall until some journalist caught a hold of it and, you know, he took it down for public relations reasons. But he certainly was very deeply involved in that kind of politics in his youth. He did not serve in the army, you know, which is the traditional trajectory of young Israeli men, because the IDF itself rejected him as a candidate, feeling that he was far too unstable to be, you know, given a gun on support of the, you know, on behalf of the State of Israel, given his background. He did go to university. He became a lawyer and spent the early years of his professional career defending clients who had been accused of settler terrorism. And then he transitioned from these kind of activist activities to becoming more involved in party politics and eventually kind of founding Otzma Yehudit and becoming a member of Knesset.
Now, Kahana himself was in the Knesset in his Kach party, which was eventually barred from the Knesset for racism. Do you see that Itamar Ben-Gvir has learned any lessons from his, shall we say, mentor?
Absolutely. I mean, Meir Kahana probably is the most important American immigrant to Israel since 1948. And I say that with great hesitancy because I can think of many more illustrious members of the Israeli society who've contributed in other ways. But unfortunately, I think Kahana has had a profound impact on a whole generation of people. You know, right around the time that Itamar Ben-Gvir was born, I guess Meir Kahana was making his first runs for Knesset in the late 1970s and then succeeding in getting into Knesset as the sole member of representing the Kach party in 1984, and then eventually having his party banned under, you know, charges of racism and incitement to violence in 1988. But his reverberations, you know, both in activist circles as well as the understanding that one could transition from activist politics to party politics was really significant for a whole generation of ultra-nationalist youth. And also that Kahana organized largely amongst young men, particularly young Mizrahi men who found themselves disenfranchised from traditional, dare I say it, Ashkenazi party politics, was also kind of a route to the Knesset for someone like Itamar Ben-Gvir.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war. You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
I have this theory that the disengagement essentially reset the settler movement in many ways. And these young people that we've been discussing, young in quotes, young to me, they're younger than I am. So these young people, Bezalel Smotrich, Itamar Ben-Gvir, others, are thinking in a different strategic mindset than the settler movement had prior to disengagement and working in the system in a very different way. Would you agree?
I think so. Although I think it goes beyond them and that you know, that sort of part of the ideological spectrum. I think everybody has had to rethink the whole idea of territorial disengagement after the Hitnatkut, because maybe it wasn't foreseen, or maybe it was. We still don't know, because the archives for these kinds of, you know, questions are not yet open. And, you know, eventually historians and scholars will have a lot more information about what Aliyah Sharon envisioned and, you know, what they thought the likely outcome was going to be. But we all know today that in 2006, Hamas took over the Gaza Strip and is, you know, in addition to persecuting the Gazan people, has also been using the Gaza Strip as a launch pad for rockets against Israel. And I don't know that, you know, the same calculations about territorial withdrawals can ever be made again in the same way, given what happened. And, you know, that kind of sense of failure to achieve, you know, two states living side by side, you know, has completely reshaped the whole political process. Also, I think young activists saw their power in the Hitnatkut. You know, they are able to mobilize people across the country. The whole idea of, you know, a Jew doesn't raise a hand against another Jew, the kind of bumper stickers that were seen across the country in 2005 and 2006, I think has also scarred the Israeli public. Those images of, you know, brother against brother dragging people out of their homes in Gaza is the image of a civil war that people in Israel are, you know, that's the nightmare of Israeli society.
I want to talk about the sense of betrayal a little bit more. In your previous book, you're now working on a new book, but in your previous book, you talked about the idea of the settler as the new pioneer. And these people were physically dragged from their homes. Many of them were children who are now in the political sphere. And they saw this huge failure of the Israel that they loved, that the land of Israel that they were raised to devote their whole lives to, turning on them and just crashing their lives down. Don't you think that this is more of a driving force than the fact that Hamas is in Gaza?
I think that the messaging on all levels was terrible. There was no real game plan for what happens the day after the withdrawal, or at least if there was, we don't exactly understand how it came to be that Hamas has now been in charge and obviously has not turned out to be a peaceful, you know, neighbor to Israel. But certainly, I think any, you know, disengagement that happens in the future cannot be modeled on that of Gaza. Not only was it the image of people being dragged out of their homes physically and the, you know, betrayal of ideals that, you know, these are the new Zionist pioneers post-1967, it's also, I think, the sense that those who were taken out of their homes, you know, there was no game plan for them in the weeks and months and years ahead. And they remained underserved and disaffected and angry and ready to mobilize against the state. And, you know, it creates, I think, a very dangerous element within society that feels entirely forsaken. And if you imagine that on a mass scale in the West Bank, it's almost impossible to understand not only how this would, you know, benefit the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, like how would that actually take place on a much larger scale than in Gaza, which was only 8,000 people, which maybe isn't a lot, but, you know, maybe is a lot, but isn't the same scale as the West Bank, but also how could Israeli society survive another Hitlerkut on a very large scale?
And so now we're faced with a coalition that is doing its utmost to make sure that there will never be another disengagement as was and maybe as could have been had it been planned a little better. And do you think that they will have this ripple effect towards the future and make it so that there will never be any hope for a Palestinian state?
Well, I mean, I think it's dependent on what the international community is going to envision as the territory of a future Palestinian state. Even if every single settler stayed in their home, which was basically what was envisioned under the Trump peace plan, that would create a Palestinian state on, say, 40% of the West Bank. There are micro states that exist in the world, but would that satisfy the Palestinian people? I highly doubt it. So I think it's really going to depend on what, you know, the compromise between the ideal and the real. I do think that the settlement block concept is still functional for the most part with, you know, with very worrying exceptions, particularly in the Jerusalem area. So I don't think that I don't think the entire rubric of Oslo has been destroyed, but it's also, it's not only what's happening on the ground, it's what's happening in people's minds. Will they tolerate another Hitlerkut of some scale in exchange for peace? And what will that peace look like? Because if it looks like what, you know, people thought it was going to look like in Gaza, I think it's a non-starter.
You talk about the idea of envisioning the peace of the day after disengagement, the day after a ceasefire, the day after peace has broke out. How do you see that?
Well, I'm really worried when I hear people on the left, right, and center saying, what does it look like the day after the occupation ends? And, you know, you'll hear this refrain, you know, from groups on the left, but also from groups on the right that want the, you know, essentially the occupation to continue. And I don't think anybody has really done enough thinking to know what that looks like. What is Palestinian civil society capable of in those moments? Could any settlers remain in their midst? You know, even ironically, Rashida Tlaib, you know, mentioned about Nakba Day that she also feels some hesitation of settlers leaving their own home, seeing the Palestinian experience in 1948. What will the international community be willing to support and, you know, possibly even fund? I think there's a lot of open questions, but it's one thing to bang the drum and say this is the policy that should happen, but it's another thing to try to enforce that without having any understanding of what the day after looks like. So if you want to say let's end the occupation, sedel, but have a plan for what's going to happen after that, because that's a very dangerous and unstable moment that doesn't justify perpetuating, you know, patterns and policies that have been in existence since 1967. But I do think that some thinking needs to be done about what exactly it looks like the day after peace emerges, because there are going to be a lot of betrayed people on all sides who no longer have an understanding of their world. Their whole universe will change overnight, and it's very hard for human beings to catch up to that. So I think we need to be preparing the groundwork for that, not just from military, economic, and defense perspective, but also from a human perspective about how to prepare people and civil society, you know, individuals and groups for that major transition.
It's a transition that so many in Israel don't think will ever happen. And we are, as you said, in this stalemate situation where the occupation continues. And it just doesn't seem like there's any readiness, willingness, or desire.
Well, maybe if people could dream about what that would look like, maybe that would help people begin to think about it. I'm not saying that they will necessarily, you know, shift ideologically, but maybe they might have more empathy for the situation and what needs to change in the future. But of course, Israel or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict isn't the only conflict around the world that's had to grapple with these questions, and not all of them have been so successful in other places either. It's a very difficult process and one that's very unstable.
Give us an example of a success story.
Well, I think the success story that everybody's pointing to in the news right now is Northern Ireland, which, you know, commemorated the 25th year of, you know, the peace in Northern Ireland only about a month ago, you know, right around the time that, you know, people were starting to worry about rockets shooting off again here. You know, the television was full of pictures of a successful or quote unquote successful peace process in Northern Ireland. But I think there's, you know, a lot simmering under the surface there, you know, tensions that have not resolved, the rearming of militant groups, the remaining isolation between different religious and ethnic factions that, it's kind of a cold peace in a way, which may be better than no peace. But I think we need to look around the world to other examples to help us envision what the future here might look like, and maybe begin to dream a little bit, but with modest expectations.
As we mentioned, you're working on a new book. Can you give us a little preview of what the idea is?
I'm thrilled to be here finally after 3 years away from Israel, and I'm resuming the research on a new book project that's called New Day in Babylon and Jerusalem, Zionism, Jewish Power, and Identity Politics since 1967, which is a real mouthful, but it's essentially a way of looking at the decades in the 1960s and 1970s as the first iteration of a lot of the contemporary debates we're having about Zionism and progressive politics, Zionism and identity politics, Black Jewish relations, and how, you know, essentially it's becoming increasingly incompatible for a young Zionist, maybe on college campus, people that I work with, you know, population I work with all the time, to both invest in their Zionist and Jewish identities as well as be, you know, comfortable and productive in a lot of identity politics spaces. And how did we get to that point? And I think we can find the answers to some of those questions 50 years ago, and maybe to try to remind my readers of how these debates played out the first time, some paths not taken back in the 1960s and 70s, where we might go from here, learning from the past.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining me.
It was lovely to be here.
Several groups of young religious teenagers wandered around the Old City's Muslim Quarter during the annual flag march. Among them were a pair of friends who came to you, they said, demonstrate for Jewish identity. When asked how they thought the local Arab population might feel about the march, the pair said, "Of course it bothers them. It bothers me that they're in my country." Special thanks to the Times of Israel's own Carrie Keller-Lynn and Jeremy Sharon for their on-site reporting and sound samples. This episode was recorded at Nomi Studios in Jerusalem with sound technician Jamal Rishek. What Matters Now is produced and edited by The Pod Waves. Have a comment about this or other episodes of What Matters Now? Email us at podcast@timesofisrael.com. Look for more What Matters Now episodes and subscribe wherever you find your podcasts. Until next week, shalom.